Good evening. You're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, the show about theater on the radio, from drama to musicals to burlesque to comedy and everything in between. I'm your host, Sarah DeA, recording from home on Thursday, July 29th, 2021. On tonight's show, playwright Arthur Holden.
But for me, if anything, the effect of COVID, the effect of staying home, was to focus my mind a little bit. You know, being told by the government, you must stay home, gave me added opportunity and added impulse to look inward.
Choreographer Helen Simard.
Why not do outdoor performances? And instead of just transposing a stage performance into an outdoor setting, why don't we reimagine the show and make kind of a remix version that's imagined for an outdoor setting and for an outdoor audience?
And André Dudemain of the Festival Présence Autochtone.
We are retaking our land, being here during the festival. And this is also completely in line with the tradition. Montreal being since eons a meeting place and a place for exchange.
Arthur Holden is a Montreal-based actor and playwright. In a play he has written over the course of the pandemic, beat out over 600 other submissions to be included in a prestigious, huge festival in Los Angeles. Of course, you don't need to be in sunny California to experience Arthur's play reading. It will be performed tomorrow evening. I spoke with Arthur last week to learn more about his new work, Beloved, a play in three waiting rooms, a story that finds a married couple struggling with the actions of their son. But before we get into that conversation, a quick mention about one item on Arthur's long CV. It includes many voice acting credits, including video games like Assassin's Creed, as well as many TV shows, including the role of teacher Mr. Ratburn in the children's cartoon series Arthur. I'm going to play some of the theme song by Ziggy Marley for you. That show stars titular young anthropomorphic aardvark and his family and friends. It was based off a series of books by U.S. author Mark Brown. And that's one of the shows I grew up with. Arthur, his sister, D.W., and their friends Buster and Francine and the rest of the gang were ordinary animals/kids living in Elwood City. But they also had their own foibles and issues that they resolved with help from each other and the adults in their lives. Topics included getting along with friends, being patient, doing homework, dyslexia, bedwetting. And of course, there were celebrity guests like Joan Rivers, Larry King, and Fred Rogers. And we learned this week, I just learned today, that Arthur is coming to a close after 25 years, the longest-running animated children's show in American history. The final series will air in 2022. Reruns will still be available on PBS Kids. And the thing about Arthur that you should know is that it was a co-production between WGBH Boston and CINAR, a Montreal-based production company now known as Wildbrain. Many of the voices were based in Montreal or had played to Montreal audiences. Ellen David, who was on Upstage 2 weeks ago, Danny Brochu, Bruce Dinsmore, Mark Camacho, Holly Gauthier-Frankel, the late Walter Massey, to name a few. So hats off to Arthur Holden, Arthur the Show, and many Montrealers who helped bring this series to children over the past quarter century. Now, I didn't get to ask Arthur Holden about this because we recorded our conversation a few days back, but in any case, I thought you might want to know about it. Arthur Holden started working on his new play, Beloved, a play in three waiting rooms over the past summer. He has a long list of shows under his belt, including Book of Bob, Battered, and Fatherland. He says he likes to weave intimate stories about relationships and the stresses within them. Here, we meet Dorothy and Stephen. They're married, they own a company that is failing fast. They are forced to confront another hard reality when they learn their son David has committed a disturbing crime at his high school English class. Beloved will be performed tomorrow night, July 30th at 9 p.m. Eastern as part of the Summer Playwrights Festival at the Rode Theater in Los Angeles. His submission was one of a few dozen selected from over 600 entries. A nice feather in your cap during what has been a tough year and a half. Of course, you can check it out online. I'll have the link after our chat. I was eager to speak with Arthur because he's so generous as a guest, and I was curious about how a writer's process would be affected by the enforced solitude of the pandemic. Is it a gift or a curse? Here's my conversation with Arthur Holden. Welcome to Upstage, Arthur. Thank you so much for taking the time. This is kind of a funny time for writers, right? Because it's a very solitary activity, but to be in a pandemic, I don't know, how has that changed your routine and your creativity?
Well, that's a great point, Sarah. The whole COVID thing, which is now a year and a half old, it's just hard to believe, has been obviously a social and a public health nightmare. But I have to admit, from a purely personal artistic standpoint, it hasn't affected me. First of all, just out of, I guess, blind luck, no one I know well, has been affected, personally infected by the virus. I have a neighbor at the end of my street who caught it with his wife and children. And they were all pretty youthful and all got through it fine. And apart from that, I know of a couple of Montreal actors who got it and also got through it fine. So I haven't been personally touched by it. And then as an artist, my job is to sit alone in a room and write, and that's not really a COVID-friendly, unfriendly activity. So I've kept that up on an ongoing basis. I've done quite a bit of writing, actually, and felt guiltily fortunate for being able to go on doing what I love doing best and not being particularly stopped by this thing that has turned the world otherwise upside down.
Right. So your writing has continued unabated, but I guess I wonder also in terms of creativity, not having maybe the same stimulation or the same brainstorming process, perhaps, because you weren't, leaving the house or having the same interactions. Did that affect the creativity process at all?
That's a really good question, actually. I imagine there are artists for whom being shut down had a huge effect. But for me, if anything, the effect of COVID, the effect of staying home, was to focus my mind a little bit. I tend to be a writer who dwells a little more on intimate subjects rather than on social themes. So I guess, I have a kind of a private outlook to start with. And being private, being told by the government, you must stay home, gave me added opportunity and added impulse to look inward. It's a really good question you're raising. I wonder if this thing went on indefinitely, I would think, oh, this is such an opportunity. I often ask myself, for instance, which is an odd question, if I were put in prison, if I were locked up, would that be a bad thing for my writing? And I often thought, no, you and your feelings, that can be very productive.
Yeah, you would just keep ticking away, keep writing.
That's it.
You just mentioned the intimacy of your stories. They're kind of stories of families and people in relationships. So let's take that and move to Beloved, your new work. We meet a married couple and they're going through some personal struggles for sure.
Mm-hmm. The struggles have already begun, we realize, as the play opens, which it does in the waiting room of a principal's office in a high school. And this couple, Dorothy and Stephen, have been called to their son's high school because he's committed a disturbing crime, really quite a disturbing crime. I actually am not going to specify the nature of the crime because I'm hoping your listeners will tune in to hear the play read. But as the parents arrive and they have this thing explained to them, frankly, they're incredulous at first. They can't believe it. But as the circumstances in which the crime was discovered are explained to them, they pass from incredulity to a kind of shocked realization that in fact this could have happened and did happen. And then to a sense that differs between them as wife and husband of how responsible they are and how specifically as individual, as parents, they are for the thing that their son has done. And that's really the trigger. All of this sort of happens in the first 15 minutes of the play. And that event, the realization that their son has done something terrible and that they bear some of the blame for that, becomes the trigger for the play as it goes on. So it unfolds in a succession of institutional waiting rooms in which their son is never present. So the son, the person who committed the crime and who turns out to be suffering terribly, who turns out to have been a victim of very, very grave traumas, he's off stage throughout the play. And the person that Dorothy and Stephen, the persons that they interact with, are a succession of young professionals working for the institutions where the married couple is waiting. And these professionals explain background facts, they explain, they deepen the parent's sense of who their son is and how he suffered. And they start to point a way forward, even as the marriage between Dorothy and Stephen encounters terrible strains that might destroy it. I don't know, is that a clear explanation of what happened?
Indeed it is. I'm speaking with Arthur Holden, playwright and performer, and we're talking about his new play, Beloved, which is about to have a reading on July 30th. And I love this concept. The full title is Beloved, A Play in Three Waiting Rooms. And you've described it, you've given us quite an evocative kind of imagining of the show itself. How did you decide to structure it through these three waiting rooms? Obviously, we're kind of in this stasis. We're waiting for something to kind of happen. They're waiting for bad news and even worse news, I guess. But how did that form in your mind?
Yeah, well, I guess I should say that as an artist and as a person, I'm very interested in transgression. I'm very interested in what happens to the human spirit and to human relationships when people do things that are more or less universally regarded as bad, as destructive. And I can't think of an activity that is really more condemned, more universally condemned than, I'm going to talk about it a little bit, than the sexual exploitation of children. This play really turns on that subject. And I knew I wanted to write about that. And I knew I wanted to write about it with my central character, with a person deeply involved in this, being a young man. And as I began to write the play in this first of three waiting rooms, the school waiting room, I was fully planning to have the young man come on stage and for the play to become his struggle to explain. But as I began to write and as I began to imagine the young man's parents, who were much closer to my age and my life experience, it became plain to me that what I really wanted to write about was their response, the ways in which they were going to grasp what their son had done and the extent to which really they were to blame for it. And from being a struggle to explain, the play became a struggle to understand. And once I had that in mind, the plot, the structure fell into place quite quickly. I realized that it would always be this wife and this husband sitting in a waiting room, anxious to be told what was going on as they struggled themselves to understand the terrible suffering their son was going through.
You've kind of hit on this a little bit, but I'm wondering, does it make it more of a challenge to write out this character who is driving forward the plot rather than include him as you had initially intended to have the son who's committed this transgression? You were going to have him in there and now he's always off stage. It's like a waiting for Godot scenario.
A little bit. Eh? Well, that's it. Yeah, that's a very good question. But in an instance like this, where the crime, which has to do with the sexual exploitation of children, is so very serious, so grave. I think that once you bring the person who has committed it on stage, necessarily that character is going to become the complete fulcrum of the play. And the concerns of those around him, while still important, will all sort of feed into the general dynamic of this address of what was done and why. And frankly, that's an area in which I would have had to do much more research. I'd have had to look into the kinds of personalities and psychiatric conditions that lead to and that proceed from that kind of behavior. And I feared, I had a couple of fears. First, that it was going to become a much more sort of medical psychiatric play rather than an emotional one. And second, that it was going to lead me into areas where I was trying to imagine something that at some level I don't really have a right to understand. You know, I was going to try and explain the conditions of a soul that were very far from my experience, and, you know, to the extent that appropriation is an issue, very far from my authority to tell. Whereas talking about parents, talking about middle-aged parents, well, that's something I have authority to do. That's something I have been and am. And that, funnily, also, is just as a dramatic issue, was an area I was more interested in. You know, again, how do people respond to transgression? How do relationships, the network, the web of relationships in which we live, how is all that affected when someone we love does something terrible? And that, for me, was a very fertile ground. And once I had this structure of three waiting rooms set up, and the three young professionals to be played by the same young woman, mm-hmm. it really played itself out for me in a way that was quite organic. The writing didn't take too long. I wrote it in the summer of 22, the deep summer of COVID. And I wrote it for three specific actors, three Montreal actors, Al Goulem, Lenny Parker, and Stephanie Costa. Stephanie's now in Toronto. But when I realized that, you know, the opportunities for a reading just weren't going to arise, I sent the play in very late autumn of 2020 to the Rode Theater in Los Angeles, because they have an annual summer playwrights festival that's the biggest of its kind on the continent. And they had put out a call for scripts, and I sent Beloved in, you know, basically because I had nowhere else to send it. And I was very honored when they came back in March with an invitation to be part of the show, a part of the festival.
Yeah, we've got, I think, a dozen plays, new plays that are going to be read out loud here. Did you have any connections to Los Angeles before you submitted this play? Like, had any of your work been performed or read over there? Like,
never. I've had a couple of play readings in New York, but nothing ever on the West Coast. And this company knew nothing about me, and I knew nothing about them, although I've subsequently learned they're a terrific company. They're quite small. They have a 100-seat house in North Hollywood. But, you know, Los Angeles being an industry town, they have some absolute dynamite actors. And in fact, their co-artistic directors, Taylor Gilbert and Sam Anderson, loved the show enough that they're co-starring in it. And they brought in a terrific director named Cameron Watson, who's a deeply experienced film and stage director, creator of an Emmy Award-winning web series. And they brought in a third actor, Cherish Monique Duke, who also has a deep resume and incredible talent. And the creative team that they, you know, put together was just stellar. I still can't believe how lucky I am.
So the neat thing is that even though this is happening in Los Angeles on the West Coast, we actually, the border won't even quite be, won't be open either way, land border by then, but you'll be able to, I assume, take this in on the web.
That is very true. We all will. It's funny, right? This is the Rode Theater's Summer Playwrights Festival is in its 12th year, but this is the second year that it's fully online and can be watched everywhere. And of course, you know, as a result, the numbers of people attending the festival have ballooned by an order of magnitude, because you don't have to get tickets to a 100-seat house. You can be anywhere on the planet. And apparently last year, and again this year, they've had viewers from every continent in the world. They've had viewers tuning in, you know, from everywhere on the planet to see these new play readings. It's terrifically exciting.
So how will you take it in yourself, seeing this new play being read by this talented cast that you were describing earlier on? Do you have any special setup at home when it gets aired?
No, that you're raising a good point. No special setup involved, and I hope all your listeners will consider tuning in. The website is Rode Theater, ROADTHEATRE.org. And you go to that website, there's a big information page for the Summer Playwrights Festival. You go to that page and you get an immediate link right there on the screen to the reading, and also a YouTube link, because you can also watch it on the Rode Theater's YouTube page. And this is happening on Friday, the 30th of July at 6 p.m. Pacific time, which means 9 p.m. our time, which, as Barb Ford very helpfully pointed out a couple of days ago, is very convenient because it means the sun has gone down in Montreal when the reading starts. So, you know, apart from stargazing, and I guess going to a club, which may or may not be legal by then, you know, you can tune in for free and watch this reading of a Montreal play done by a terrific Los Angeles company.
Arthur, what would be your wildest dream for having this play? Like, you've had other plays performed and produced, but to have this one, this pandemic play being read on the other side of the continent in an industry town like this, like, what's the biggest hope that you would want to pin or want to confess to pinning on the
What a lovely question. The answer would be that this same team, Cameron and Taylor and Sam and Cherish, love the play enough after they've read it that they think, yeah, let's do this. And that the Rode Theater in Los Angeles actually programmed the play for a full production, because I think they're going to be returning to actual real live theater production next year. And if they love this play enough to do it, that would be a dream come true.
How exciting. Well, Arthur Holden, congratulations on having this play being selected for the festival. And thank you for telling us, taking us behind the scenes to your process and to the intricacies of creating a play and setting it up like this. We appreciate it.
It is I who appreciate it. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk, Sarah. And I hope your listeners consider tuning in to see this, to watch the reading.
That was Arthur Holden, author and playwright. His new play, Beloved, will be performed as part of the Summer Playwright Festival in Los Angeles tomorrow evening, July 30th at 9 p.m. Eastern. But you don't have to go to LA to see it. Stream it on YouTube. Visit rodetheatre.org, RODTHEATRE.org for the link under Summer Playwrights Festival. I'm Sarah DeA, and you're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, coming to you from my home yet again this week. Still to come, the 31st edition of the Festival International Présence Autochtone returns next week during a summer of painful reckoning. What kind of reflection and message are organizers hoping to send? We will find out. Now, back in the fall, I spoke with choreographer Helen Samard about her new work, Papillon. The COVID crisis being what it was and public health rules being in flux, her brand new show was canceled days before opening. Instead, her team shifted to presenting the show online. Her three dancers, Nindy Banks, Mekti Jean-Pierre, and Toria McKenzie, each interpreting Helen's original hip-hop-inspired steps with their own style. Dividers kept them apart from each other, the crew, and the band, both for safety and as a nod to the current conditions. Helen's work draws on rock and roll and the kinetic energy from hip-hop and contemporary dance, but Papillon is still gentle in its own way, touching on an individual's own impact in the world. Now the work is being revamped as Papillon L'Envolée. It's presented in secret pop-up locations around Montreal through the summer. Let's find out how to get a ticket. I spoke with Helen Samard a few days ago. Welcome, Helen, back to Upstage. How are you today?
I'm doing great, Sarah. It's always such a pleasure to talk to you.
Well, thank you. The feeling is absolutely mutual. We're revisiting a show that we spoke about a few months back, and I'm really excited that you are bringing this back to a live audience.
Me too.
Why don't we do some recapping? Papillon L'Envolée. It's a bit of an up and down story. Canceled shows, going online now as a pop up event. Tell me maybe about the seeds, how this dance show first got started in your mind.
Oh my God! I mean, this is what's so weird. Papillon is a project that I had an idea for. Actually, we were just talking about it in rehearsal last week. We got the idea for this show in 2017. When I created a solo for Victoria McKenzie, who's a B-girl, and, you know, as listeners might or might not know, I B-girled for about 16, 17 years. I was very active in the hip-hop community. I stopped breaking a few years ago because of injuries. I can't do that dance form anymore. And so
it's a very grueling practice, right?
I mean, it's a dance invented by teenage boys, let's be honest. And so, you know, as a 40-something-year-old woman, at a certain point, my neck was like, you can't do this anymore. And so I had stopped breaking. I was more involved in a contemporary dance practice and had decided to kind of work again with somebody who had a hip-hop background, had a breaking background, who had maybe a movement style that was more similar to mine in my training, just to see how that would influence the way I would choreograph. And so I made a solo for Victoria that we presented at the May in 2017. And then I was so excited about the process that I said, well, why don't we do this same process but work with three dancers and make three different solos for three different dancers, but all starting from the same movement vocabulary. And so, you know, projects take time. There's a cycle of there's a life cycle in a show where it takes time to get the idea off the ground, get people on board, get funders on board, get partners on board to present the work. And we had just started working in January 2020, finally, and then COVID happened. And so this show that I had already been imagining for 2 years and doing research about and thinking about had to change radically very quickly. We rehearsed on Zoom for 4 months. We had to completely reimagine what the show was. The dancers couldn't be in any contact at all because of COVID. We had to think of a set design that had plastic partitions on stage so that the dancers, you know, wouldn't be in danger being close to each other. And then 3 days before our premiere at La Chapelle, the shows got canceled because of COVID. And so all this work we had done was only shared via live stream. And thank goodness for the live stream. It let us reach a completely different audience. And it was an amazing experience. But, you know, we are in the performing arts. It is live art. And so we were hoping to have the chance again to perform the work on stage. But, you know, as COVID has taught us to do, it's taught us to pivot a million times. When the opportunity was presented to do outdoor shows, we decided, why not do outdoor performances? And instead of just transposing a stage performance into an outdoor setting, why don't we reimagine the show and make kind of a remix version that's imagined for an outdoor setting and for an outdoor audience? And so Papillon has become Papillon L'Envolée, or kind of the flight of the butterfly. And we're hoping that finally with this kind of little pop-up informal showings in people's backyards, we're finally going to get the chance to come and meet the audience and come out of the cocoon.
That's so fantastic to hear. How is the stage going to be reinvented? Because to my memory, seeing the show online, you know, you were kind of riffing on the fact that people like couldn't be in touch with each other. You also had to follow those guidelines, as you were just mentioning, about keeping the dancers apart. And all these plexiglass panels, right, that were coming up between us at work and at and offices and at service centers, restaurants and all that. I find that's kind of a neat reference because we were seeing some of those barriers for your dancers. Is that going to still be part of the element outdoors, or is that gone by the wayside?
It's completely gone by the wayside because what we thought was that, you know, it makes such a specific reference to a specific time and a specific experience that we were all going through collectively of being kind of closed off from each other with plastic barriers or plexiglass barriers, and the decision to work with the set designer, Robin Fisher, who designed these partitions so that we would be safe, but that also we felt echoed the loneliness of last fall, of fall 2020, felt a bit strange to bring into an outdoor setting when actually we're in a time where we're opening up. We have more liberties and we have more opportunity to connect with each other in a different way. And so instead of using the set and using the barriers and using those restraints that we had at that time, we said, why don't we permit ourselves to reimagine the work and re-choreograph it for this outdoor setting? So it's not the same piece at all. It's almost like we're speaking the same language, but we're saying something different because we're at a different place as a community and as a society. And so the version that we'll see in outdoors is actually closer to my original idea of the work. It's three solos presented one at a time. So the dancers are on stage one at a time. They're all dancing on the same piece of music and they're interpreting the same movement material, but their way. And so what we really see is the interpreter's singularity, their uniqueness, and the creativity that they bring to my universe.
I'm speaking with choreographer Helen Simard of Papillon L'Envolé, kind of a redux or a remix of her original presentation that's been in development for the last few years. I'm curious about the individual artists. We see Nindy Banks, Mehdi Jean-Pierre, Victoria McKenzie, who you spoke a little bit earlier on in our chat. Their individual styles that are, they're kind of taking your work and putting their spins on it. Can, in a couple of words, can you tell me about what you've noticed from each dancer, what they kind of bring from a choreographer's eye to your work?
My work is so influenced by the dancers I work with. I'm really interested in meeting someone and us meeting each other halfway. So the movement that I propose, I always say the movement itself is not precious. What I want to see is how you understand and how you're delighted by the movement that I propose as an interpreter. And so these are three dancers who have similar but different backgrounds. Nindy is a hip-hop dancer and a crumper. Mehdi is a popper. Victoria is a B-girl. And so they all have the street dance experience in common and a freestyle experience in common. They're all very musical dancers who improvise very well, but they're dancing in very, very different techniques. So what each one sees in my movement and my way of dancing is very different. I often find that Mehdi gets obsessed with a tiny little movement and turns it into a whole universe of concepts. And so he'll take 1 second of my movement and develop it into 10 minutes. Nindy is someone who is very methodical and very precise. She will watch videos of me dancing and break down every single tiny detail and then kind of turn it into her own and really embody it. Whereas Victoria kind of sometimes latches onto the energy of my dancing and the kind of explosive rawness that's in my dancing, and she really eats that up and invests herself emotionally in the work. So even though these three dancers started off with the same movement vocabulary, you know, we started with the same language, they're all saying something very, very different. And I think we're at a time in society where it's important to respect the things that are different about us and also see the things that bring us together. And I think that these three dancers have done a beautiful job of embodying and inhabiting my universe, but still staying true to themselves. And the thing we've created together is not something I could have imagined or they could have imagined beforehand. We've really collaborated and done something unique.
The fact that the initial show presented online was recorded, it was broadcast and rebroadcast later. Is that something that you guys have returned to at all as a touch point? You know, being able to see what was done in that space, or is this really your forward looking, interpreting it moving forward?
It's really been kind of a strange struggle because when you're working in live performance, every night is different.
Yeah.
And with Papillon, because so much of the work was about improvising within really set structures, the work is very written, but it has a lot of space for spontaneity. And so when we came back and started watching the live stream recording, that's actually not the show. It's a snapshot in time. It's one night where we performed with seven cameras in our faces. So it's a very specific performance of the show. But because all of the live performances were canceled, that's the only version that the audience had access to. And so in a way, it became kind of this like ultimate reference at first. And we had to really work to detach ourselves from what we were seeing on the screen and actually remember what we were feeling in those moments and what we were trying to express. And so we came back to it and revisited it, but in a way we had to detach ourselves from the image we had created and get back to the experience. And I think that that's a struggle right now with bringing live performance into live stream contexts. As soon as you've recorded something, it becomes about the image. Mm. And dance, I think, is the art of the body above all. And so how can we bring images back into our bodies and live them again, as opposed to just recreating the thing we see on the screen?
Speaking with choreographer Helen Simard behind Papillon L'Envolée, coming to an outdoor space near you this summer. We'll get to that in just a moment. But hearing you talk about the live stream version from a couple of months back. As I remember correctly, there was also a Q&A after the performance with those many multiple cameras you were just describing. After the show came to an end, you, your composer Roger White, your partner, and the dancers came back on stage and answered questions from the audience. So not only did the show happen live and in this very strange environment, but you were also deconstructing it and analyzing it immediately after and taking questions from the audience and kind of interpreting it in this intense way and having to kind of walk away now from that.
Oh, yeah, it's such a strange experience. And it's strange, again, thinking about, you know, we're all deconfining together. The dancers I'm working with haven't performed for a live audience, some of them, in a year and a half. We're really thinking about, you know, almost that experience of talking to cameras right away is less intimidating than coming back to a live group of people, even if we're going to be performing outdoors, which is much more informal than in a theater. There's something about that live encounter, that rawness of meeting a spectator face to face, that we're all very curious to see how it goes. I'm not saying that there's a stage fright, but that there's a sense of a removal that we've had from the work for the past 18 months that now we're going to be really confronted with being faced with real live audience members. So, you know, I think all of these formats have their challenges, and I think that COVID is letting us experiment with new formats that we might not have otherwise. And what I kind of love about Papillon as a process is that because, you know, the rules have changed so many times on us, everything's been canceled, we've had to pivot 20,000 times, that we all kind of accept that Papillon is a new experience every time. And so the live stream experience was a beautiful experience, and it was a strange experience, and it was a challenging experience. And outdoor shows will be another type of challenge, and another type of new, and another type of strange, and another type of beautiful.
Helen, you're working with Art Out in the Open, which is part of the Conseil des Arts de Montréal, which is working to bring arts to Montrealers in their neighborhoods, whether it's outdoors or indoors. How did you partner with this program?
So this is a program that was launched last year during the pandemic, the Conseil des Arts de Montréal being very supportive of artists in the Montreal community. It's an amazing arts council that really supports the arts in our city in such an amazing way. And they had decided to launch this program to make a call for outdoor performances, because as we all know, last year, 2020, there were no theatrical performances allowed. And so the idea was to really bring artists into communities, do very informal presentations in private settings, backyards, parking lots, a window of a store, and kind of take art out of just, you know, institutionalized spaces and bring it back to communities. They had such success last year with the program. There was such a great response to it that they decided to run the program again this year. So, you know, we applied. There was an application in the spring. We submitted our project. It was selected, and we're going to be performing in a number of private backyards for very small audiences of maybe 10 to 15 people, depending on what the regulations are later on in the summer. And we're also partnered now with XP Montréal, and so we're going to be doing some performances for larger groups of people at the garden at the monastery downtown on St. Catherine Street. But I think that, you know, programs like Art in the Open are so important, because it's very easy for art to become removed from everyday people and become removed from everyday lives. And we think about it as this thing that you have to go into a theatrical space to encounter, or you have to go into a museum to encounter. And we put a lot of value on those institutions instead of on the exchange with audiences. And so I'm very excited kind of to, you know, get to perform in a space that's not about a perfect tech and perfect conditions and everything having to be hidden from the audience. I'm excited that they're going to see the transitions between the dancers. They're going to see if we have technical issues. Someone's dog might bark in the background. And as artists, we have to be open to sharing our practice in so many different ways right now, because as long as theaters might or might not stay shut, and audiences might not be comfortable coming into theaters, we have to find new ways to reach audiences. Because I think at the end of the day, that's what art is about. It's about communication, it's about exchange, and it's about going out and meeting people and having meaningful exchanges. And so if we can't do that in theaters right now, I'm happy to do it in someone's backyard with their dog.
So well put, Helen. I love that sentiment. Now, if we really, really want to go see a show, this is only being unveiled until 24 hours in advance. How do we get a ticket and find out about those shows? Do we go to We All Fall Down, your site, or?
Yeah, so information about different performances will be available on my website, which is wafdcreations.com. You can also just look up We All Fall Down Montreal, and you can find us on social media. The neighborhoods where we'll be performing will be announced ahead of time. People who are interested in shows can reserve tickets through the website or by emailing us. Some of the shows really will be for 10 spectators at a time. Some of them will be for larger groups of maybe up to 100 spectators. And so depending on the location or where you are in the city, you might have a better chance of getting in. But the specific location will only be, shared 24 hours before the show, just to protect the privacy of the people who are opening up their homes and their yards to us and make sure that we're not broadcasting people's private addresses on the internet.
Fair enough. It's going to be a hot ticket, I think, with these
restrictions. I think it is. Yeah. I mean, I already know so many people who are like, I want to come. So I think make sure you check our website. Make sure you check our social media. Dates will be announced, and I think they will be hot tickets.
Do you have people coming up to you saying, you can take my backyard, I volunteer?
There's people who are so excited about it, and I think it's exciting for people because, again, of this. Well, first of all, because so many people have been deprived of live performance for a year and a half, so people are hungry for it and are hungry to support artists. But I also think that for some people, it's a way to engage with art in a way they haven't had the opportunity to before. And so it's a way to think about how art fits into their personal lives and the importance of art in their personal lives, why art is essential and why it's important to open up our spaces and our lives to share that with others.
Helen, it's been a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much, Sarah. It's always a pleasure.
That was choreographer Helen Simard. You are hearing music from her show, Papillon, composed by her partner, musician Roger White. Papillon L'Envolé is being adapted for outdoor shows through the rest of the summer. Each performance and location is secret until 24 hours before showtime. You can reserve tickets through her organization's website, wafdcreations.com. WAFD stands for We All Fall Down, which is her organization based around her work. They are also on Facebook if you want to give them a like and get updates, wafdcreations.com. I'm Sarah De A, and you're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at ckut.ca, coming to you from my home yet again this week. The 31st edition of the Festival International Présence Autochtone, or the International First Peoples Festival, is coming during a summer of reckoning for Indigenous peoples in Canada. This week, the first ever Indigenous Governor General was installed, an Inuk woman from Northern Quebec named Mary Simon. And there are plans to investigate mass graves located at residential schools all over the country. While Indigenous Canadians are talking about the racism and colonialism they experience daily, asking for more representation and action for better opportunities and treatments in all facets of life, while settler Canadians are trying to, or should be trying to, figure out what they can do to improve this situation. Présence Autochtone has for decades showcased Indigenous talent across a spectrum of disciplines. And while this is a difficult year, founder André Dunemain is hoping to strike a positive note during the fest. It's based in and around Place des Festivals, with evening concerts, dozens of films, and outdoor exhibits for Montrealers. André is Innu and the founder of Terre en Vue and director of Présence Autochtone. I spoke with André a few days back. André, bienvenue à Upstage. Thank you for being here. How have you been these past couple of months?
Well, it has been hectic because we were wondering if, at first we were wondering if we were being able to have a festival, and finally, yes, we can have the event with real people and public and in not quite a normal way, because there is a lot of limitations. But at the same time, this is the beginning of the end of the pandemic period, and we begin to see the light at the end of the tunnel.
Indeed. And it's also a remarkable time for Canada's Indigenous communities and First Nations people, a time of reckoning. A lot of people have been calling it that. What can you tell me about producing this festival and starting it in the climate that we're in right now, the conversations that have been unfolding over the last couple of months and weeks?
Well, the difference, of course, will be in the relation with the public in general and the festival goer that are now more aware of all the significations of Aboriginal art, how it is an art of healing, of survivance, and of resistance. This gives all the value of the works made by the Aboriginal artists in a very difficult time, and how we are now looking at a better future, and how the cultural role of the artist is one of the leading role on the path of better living for the future.
I think for a lot of communities, Indigenous communities, there's been this sense of, you know, the settler communities or everybody else reawakening to understand just how grave, how difficult life has been for decades, for centuries. Is that like a theme perhaps that we've always seen in a lot of art that you've been cultivating and programming, that there's this sense that the wider community in Canada has not been aware of how much injustice is a part of our history?
Well, just the fact to take place in the city is in itself an act of resistance and of renaissance too, because we know that as Indigenous people in general and as Indigenous cultures and arts, we have been put aside in reserve and certainly outside the cultural hubs. So we are retaking our land, being here during the festival, and this is also completely in line with the tradition. Montreal being since eons a meeting place and a place for exchange. When tribes from the north were coming south to trade with the agricultural societies of the south, Montreal was just at the frontier between the two zones, the two geographical zones. So this is for us almost a ritual of coming back to a very old activity by being here with this kind of activity. And of course, we are in the 21st century, so we have films, we have all kind of artistic expression, some very modern. We are in the gallery, for example, La Guilde with Sonia Robertson, who is contemporary arts artist. But at the same time, she asked some members of the Aboriginal community in Montreal to make embroideries to bring as an offering to complete one of the installations she will have in the exhibit. So this is you can see that how this connection with traditions is not lost, by contemporary side of the artistic, of the nowadays artistic expression. And this is also the same on Place des Festivals. If you look at the scenography, we have a 100 feet teepee, which is more a sculpture, a kind of evocation, an allegory, I would say, of the traditional Aboriginal architecture of the land. But at the same time, this is a beautiful place with evocation of all the spirits of the land, but it is also a very modern and urban artistic space where you can hear concerts during several nights during the festival. Obviously, Sanyan will be there with a new album and of singing several songs in his own ancestral language, the Algonquin, the Anishinaabe. And this is, he represents a very strong voice because there is wrath, there is hope, there is history in the rap he does, and this is really something that when you are live in a Sanyan concert, you are deep in the Aboriginal realities and in the indigenous psyche of contemporary First Nations people. And this is the same for a movie. There is a lot of movies that are about reconnection. We have, it's funny, we have two movies entitled Grandfather. One is Sotzil from Mexico, Tote is Grandfather, and the other one is in Inuktitut Atatasiak, who means also grandfather. And the last one is by Lisa Koperkwaluk, who is an Inuit woman living in Montreal, but she is from up north. She has grown very traditionally, and she goes and meets her grandfather, and this is the same with the Nawa director. She goes to meet her grandfather, and it's interesting. They spoke in Nawatl. It's very simple, but at the same time, you can see an Aboriginal indigenous woman living the life we live in the cities, but keeping preciously this connection with the elders and with the community, and bringing a film that gives you the sense of how today the cultures and the spirit are all and still alive.
I'm speaking with André Dudemain, who is one of the founders of Terre en Vue and director of the Montreal First Peoples Festival, beginning August 3rd to the 11th. So we were just talking about one of the opening shows on August the 6th, rapper Samian, and then also your film component. And there's going to be an interesting presentation by Atikamekw playwright Véronique Hébert that I wanted to ask you about. I think this is August 8th and 9th.
Yes, that's well. Usually, we try to bring something new on Place des Festivals. Obviously, especially in touristic season, Well, this year there is no touristic season for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
We try to have popular music concerts by night because this is how you get a lot of people. You attract a great public and a great number on the Place du Festival. But this year, nobody asked us to do that. On the contrary, they asked us to limit the public. So this is a good time. We thought the good side of it is that we can take unusual path and try something special. So we have this experimental performance with a theatrical text. The characters will stand on the scene with a makeup, and they will interpret this very beautiful poetical theatrical dialogue of Véronique Hébert, while young Atikamekw will dialogue in a sense with the dialogue, because they will use DJing to bring images about the territory, that the land, about the history of the Atikamekw people and their connection to Mother Earth. All this will be expressed, of course, in the text mainly, but this will be accompanied with live montage of images, and also by live improvised music by Emilio Wawati, who is an Anishinaabe guitarist and composer. So there is two representations. They will be slightly different because there is a place for
improvisation.
Yeah.
Oh, it's very exciting. So that's August 8th and the 9th at the Quebecor stage at the Quartier des Spectacles. Andre, there's so much happening for the festival this year, and I'm wondering if there's something that you in particular are looking forward to.
Well, I think in the spirit of the circle, which is the traditional indigenous way to look at the world, every part of the event is part of the circle. There is no hierarchy. So I think you can choose what you want, and seeing one film, being at one concert, or looking at one piece of art in the gallery, you are connected with the whole. And I would say go ahead, and being part of the festival is not, I often say, without offending nobody, of course, this is not a festival just for laughs. This has a profound meaning, and being there, you are giving something also. You are by connecting to the Renaissance of the First Nations, you are opening doors toward a better future for all of us.
That was André Dudemaine, founder of Terre en Vue and director of Montreal First Peoples Festival, or Présence Autochtone. The festival launches August 3rd, this coming Tuesday, and runs until August 11th. For tickets, schedules, and more information, please visit présenceautochtone.ca. You can visit their Facebook page for more information. You have been listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca. Tonight you heard choreographer Helen Simard, playwright Arthur Holden, and André Dudemaine of the festival Présence Autochtone. A big thank you to my guests. You can hear past episodes of Upstage at CKUT.ca under Archives. Thank you to Jack Soler, our spoken word coordinator, for making sure this show gets to air. And thank you for tuning in. I'm your host, Sarah Day. Speak with you next time on Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca. Stay safe and have fun.
It takes a good dose of courage and perseverance to get through a pandemic.
True, but it also takes a good dose of patience, resilience, confidence, optimism, humor, and love. Not to mention a dose of determination, endurance, empathy, motivation, hope, and ingenuity.
But above all, it takes a second dose of vaccine.
A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
Are you a tenant in Montreal? Do you have questions about your rights? Your local housing committee can help. To find the housing committee for your neighborhood or for more resources, go to www.rclalq.qc.ca.
From 88 megahertz up to 108.
You've got this frequency. We're going to call you CKUT. You've got this frequency, 98.3. That frequency is what you're picking up when you tune that radio.
Very impressive.
You can sit on the moon and it looks like they pick up CKUT, clear as a bell.
Fascinating. Your analysis seems logical.
CKUT is on the air.
Vaccination against COVID-19 is ongoing throughout Quebec. The combined effect of two doses ensures better efficacy of the vaccine, reducing the risk of getting and transmitting the virus. You'll also stay protected for a longer period of time. Coming to your appointment for the second dose of the vaccine is a must, whatever else is on your schedule. The second dose of vaccine is essential. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
Following is a previously broadcast program.
I think we need to have discipline, we need to have strategy, we need to have a deep critique of capitalism, right? But I also think that doesn't mean, again, that we're just telling people these are your marching orders. I mean, I think we really have to cultivate a community of critical, responsive, engaged, curious people, right? And that it's like, to me, if you want to actually build power and be a leftist, then it's just not about your voice, your opinions, your righteousness. It really is about becoming part of a collective project.